Now that this week in global history is history, it's time to sit back, relax, and relive the week that was in global history class. Coming to you live from 235, Mr. Palumbo is ready to take you on a journey into the past to understand the present and change the future. Welcome to Enduring Issues.
Hello, everybody,
and welcome to Enduring Issues for the second week of December 2019. The focus for us this week, we're transitioning from the end of World War I to the beginning of World War II. All right, the previous war, World War I, so known as the Great War, can't be called World War I until there's a Second World War. And that transition, that lead up to the Second World War is what we're looking at here this week. We wrapped up the end of last week, again, with the Treaty of Versailles ending World War I. Aspects of it, the things that leads to some discontent among some countries, big reparations that Germany's going to have to pay, and how other countries are involved with the end of World War I. There's some issues that we addressed at the beginning of this week that technically take place while World War I is still going on, and the seeds of which actually have been laid many decades prior to that even. The event that we're talking about, that we looked at the first half of the week, of course, is the Russian Revolution. The Russian Revolution is something that is going to officially happen, this transition of power in Russia and changing from Russia to the Soviet Union is going to occur the very, very tail end of World War I and just after. We wrapped up World War I to get that kind of taken care of and put to bed. Now we're jumping back a little bit. To look at the start of the Russian Revolution, the events during it, and the impacts of it. Obviously, for a country to go through a revolution, for the people to be so upset with their leadership, to have so many different grievances, that they want a completely new government established, there has to be a long history of grievances of the people towards their government. And it is that long history that we began looking at at the beginning of this week, right, to go back and get those historical circumstances. We can't just jump right in with a Russian Revolution, the people rising up and casting off their current system. We need to understand why they're doing that, right? We need to go back to the start to get those foundational pieces, the building blocks of that Russian Revolution. The first one that we look at, we went all the way back to 1848. In the publication of Karl Marx and Frederick Engels' book, The Communist Manifesto. The ideas laid out in it, the plan for communism, this society where, this classless society where workers and owners are kind of on the same level, where there's government control of factors of production, this command style of economy. The ideas for this are laid out in that manifesto, that 1848 manifesto. And the ideas that come from Marx and Engels are the first building block moving towards revolution in Russia, right? We're still 70 years away from it happening, but those ideas need to get implanted first. And there's a lot of similarities, a lot of connections we're able to make between the Russian Revolution and the French Revolution. And one of those similarities is you need an initial set of ideas, right, for people to build on. In the case of the French Revolution, obviously, it's the Enlightenment ideas of Locke and Montesquieu and Rousseau, going back to the beginning of the year. But we see that parallel, the recipe for how a revolution happens. Fast forwarding, all right, about 60 years or so, a little bit less, to the next event in Russian history that's going to move towards the Russian Revolution, and that is the Russo-Japanese War. This is another review piece, something we covered previously during our imperialism unit. We looked at it from the Japanese perspective of Japanese trying to imperialize mainland Asia and to gain more resources for themselves. Here now we're going to look at it from the Russian perspective, right? Russia, landmass-wise, largest country in the world. Technically, in Europe and in Asia, but the vast majority of the population lives in Europe, so they consider themselves a European Western nation, industrialized. So when this war starts, this Russo-Japanese War in 1905, it's assumed that Russia is just going to dominate the Japanese, right? The small island, you know, East Asian nation, Russia is just going to dominate, and most players on the world stage believe that as well. So when the shocking outcome arrives and the Japanese defeat the Russians in the Russo-Japanese War, it's a cause of national embarrassment. All right, that the mighty Russia would lose to little Japan. And much like a football team, you know, losing a game that they're supposed to win to a lesser opponent, the blame for that is going to fall on the leader, right? It's going to fall on the head coach. In this case, it's going to fall on the Tsar. Tsar is the Russian term, you know, for their king, for their monarch, Tsar Nicholas II, Nicholas Romanov. He's going to get a lot of heat for this loss to the Japanese and this national embarrassment. He's going to be blamed for being a weak monarch, not ready to lead, not ready for the world stage. And that reputation is amongst the Russian people is going to linger and is going to stay with him. A major event in Russian history and moving towards this revolution is going to occur simultaneously. It's going to occur while the Russo-Japanese War is happening. It's an event that occurs back home. In January 1905, Russians are gonna gather. They're gonna organize themselves, and they're gonna create a list of demands, a list of grievances, to bring to Tsar Nicholas. Things like higher wages, things like freedom of speech, things that people around the world have always fought for, right, and have always advocated for. These issues are enduring, correct? So they're gonna bring these grievances to Tsar Nicholas's front steps. They bring them to the Winter Palace, where Tsar Nicholas takes up residence. Thousands of people show up. Workers, peasants, you know, folks from all over Russia show up here to protest and to fight for these rights. The protesters are not met with a listening ear. Right, they're not met by a respectful leader willing to hear their grievances. They're met with gunfire. They're fired on by the Tsar's guards at the Winter Palace. Upwards of 200 individuals are killed in an event known as Bloody Sunday. And this is going to set off, again, firestorm throughout Russia. It's another example here of Tsar Nicholas just not being ready. Tsar Nicholas not listening to the voice of the people. And another major grievance of the people towards the current Russian government as it is established. But again, this is only 1905, right? The date we have for the Russian Revolution is 1917. We're still 12 years off, right? There's still a lot that needs to happen. Many events need to stack up in order to have a revolution. It's what Thomas Jefferson, the Declaration of Independence, calls a long train of abuses need to happen before you can cast off your government. The seminal event that's going to take place in those 12 years, right, the main thing that's going to happen, obviously, is World War I. So between 1914 and 1918, that's going to dominate. Russia is obviously a part of it, jumping in on the side to defend Serbia, fighting with France and England against Germany and Austria-Hungary. So Russia is going to play a major role. Russia is going to have the most casualties of any nation in World War I. They're going to lose 1.7 million men are going to be killed. They're upwards of 75% of the Russian army is going to see casualties, either killed, injured, captured, missing. So Russia is going to see the largest amount of human loss in World War I. And this, again, is going to be an area of grievance that the people are going to have with Russian leadership. They're going to have with the Tsar, right? They're sending their sons and brothers and husbands off to this war, and they're getting massacred in huge numbers. All right, that's really unacceptable. And back home, the situation is also dire. There's massive food shortages, protests in the streets. The czar and the government are not able to support the troops on the battlefront. They're not able to support the people on the home front. And there's this tremendous growing discontent. And an individual sees this as an opportunity. He's currently a prisoner of the Germans, and the Germans see a way to get Russia out of the war, right? To free up their Eastern Front. So the Germans release their political prisoner, a man by the name of Vladimir Lenin. He is released back to Russia. Lenin is a student of Karl Marx. He is an advocate of communism. He is a political agitator, an organizer. And he is dropped, as some historians say, almost like a bomb into the middle of Russia. So he's going to take his communistic ideas, and he's going to spread these to an already really unhappy population. All right, and communism is going to appeal to the poor. It's going to appeal to the disenfranchised with promises of equality, right? Being raised up to the middle sounds pretty good. When you're very low, it sounds pretty bad when you're really high up in society. But he's going to come back to Russia and spread his ideas about how the bourgeoisie, the upper class, has been abusing and exploiting the proletariat, the working class. And this message is going to resonate with these disgruntled and discontented Russian citizens. It's going to culminate with Vladimir Lenin taking power, right? The king, Tsar Nicholas, sees this growing movement. He knows that his time as king is coming to an end. He abdicates the throne, a big fancy word for giving up power. And Lenin and the Bolsheviks take control. Right, they are now in charge of Russia. They rename it the Soviet Union. The flag changes, all those different changes that take place after a revolution. We read some documents from that time period, some speeches of Lenin's, the events of October, the 25th and 26th of the October Revolution in 1917. And we read about the eventual fate of Tsar Nicholas Romanov and his family. The Tsar Nicholas and his family are executed by the Bolshevik forces in 1918. And this is just a way to completely erase any hint of a monarchy, any hint of the old system, wiping out the king and any heirs to the throne, so as they can't be, you know, something to rally around for those that oppose him politically. And Lenin's going to start a terror campaign, or continue a terror campaign, to keep the people in Russia in line, to limit opposition to his rule and his power. And with that, the Russian Revolution is really complete. We're going to revisit Russia in a little bit as we lead up more towards World War II. But from there, we transition to a different country, a country that's also going through very difficult economic times after World War I, a country that saw the second most losses in World War I, and a country that's going to follow a very similar pattern that Russia does. We moved to Germany. Germany is struggling tremendously economically after World War I. There's a worldwide depression that hits Germany especially hard. The people are again, starving. Unemployment is a tremendous problem. They have problems with hyperinflation, a term that we worked with the other day, explaining that money is just losing its value. We saw images of kids playing with stacks of money, stories of people having to bring, you know, buckets and wheelbarrows full of cash to the market just to buy a few simple items. So their economy is in shambles. Not helping that fact, obviously, is the way World War I ends and the provisions of the Treaty of Versailles that take away German colonies, that limit German military, and most importantly, add a huge amount of reparations, a huge amount of debt that Germany is going to have to pay And again, that payment is not completely finished until 2010, right? Just to show the magnitude of that. So Germany, much like Russia, is in the same place, right? You have the citizens being in a state of discontent. They are unhappy with their leadership. They don't think that they're doing enough to help and support the people and stand up for them on the world stage. They felt that they were taken advantage of. In the Treaty of Versailles, they had no voice in the Treaty of Versailles. The people are unhappy. And just like Russia, they're going to look to a leader that can promise them help and assistance. All right, so much like Vladimir Lenin, someone with questionable character and morals, all right, the citizens are able to look past that with the promises of peace, land, and bread. The citizens of Germany are going to look for a strong leader as well. That's going to come in the form of Adolf Hitler. We didn't get too much into the specifics of Hitler. We wanted to understand more the economies. You know, as people ask, you know, how could a country sign up and select a leader like this? How can they allow a madman to take over their country in this way? And you really got to go back and understand the economic situation and the political situation and the historical circumstances of the time and understand what people are going through and what they're looking for and the promises that they're susceptible to be duped by. And they were. The final day of the week, here on Friday, we did a little bit more with Adolf Hitler and the rise of him in Germany and becoming a little more known among the German people. He still hasn't taken control yet, right? He's still not the Führer, right? We're still just understanding his rise through the ranks of the National Socialist Party. And we introduced a third individual today as well, Benito Mussolini. In Italy. Italy, again, kind of the same story, right, over and over again. A country that's struggling after World War I, a country that feels the war didn't go the right way for them, the ending of the war, rather, didn't go the right way for them. They'd hoped to gain more after World War I. They blame their weak leadership for that, so they're going to look for a stronger leader. And that comes in the form of Benito Mussolini. And we did some comparisons today of Hitler and Mussolini around the vocab term of fascism, understanding that both of these leaders are self-proclaimed fascists, all right, fascist dictators, and having the ability to understand that word can tell us a lot about these individuals and how they're going to rule their country, right? So some elements of fascism, obviously extreme nationalism, right, this idea that your country is far superior, your culture, your way of life, far superior to all others. The reliance and the focus on the state, all right, that it the control it needs to have in everybody's lives, right, that the state needs to make all decisions, right, that the state has total power, right, and the state is in, you know, in the form of these fascist dictators. And to understand what fascism is, we also need to learn about what it is not, right? And this helps us to differentiate between terms, between governing styles. So, you know, we talked a lot about communism earlier in the week, and students can sometimes get those misconstrued, can sometimes assign the wrong leader to the wrong term. So just to help out with that a little bit, we understood how and why fascism is not communism. All right, so being able to understand some specifics of these two can really help us to separate those and ensure that mix-ups don't happen. Right, communism, again, promises equality among people. It's a classless society. Fascism is the opposite of that. Fascism believes in superiority, that certain people and certain groups are better than other people and groups. And those people that are better, usually by birth, have the right to be and must be in superior positions to those that are weaker, those that are lesser. All right, so fascism and communism are complete opposites in that regard. Fascism is also not democracy. In a democracy, the citizens get to pick who their leaders are. They get to elect who their leaders are. Fascists have a problem with this. All right, they feel that democracy diminishes nationalism, right? If there's a national election, democratic election, and, you know, 65% of the people pick one candidate, 35% pick another candidate, that leads to division. Not everybody is pulling for the same team, right? Not everybody is supporting the leader, supporting the state, right? You still have that 35% of the people that aren't as engaged or involved or as motivated as they should be. So fascism believes in one single strong leader. All right, so everyone in the country can rally around that person. Now, obviously, that's going to lead to all sorts of corruption. It's going to lead to violence towards the opposition, to crushing any opposition, lack of rights, freedom of speech, things like that. And those are things we're going to get into a little more specifically next week. But this week was really all about understanding first the Russian Revolution, the lead up to it, and how that all played out, that full transition from a monarchy under Tsar Nicholas to Vladimir Lenin being in charge. And we wanted to lay the foundations for this rise of dictators that we're going to see in Europe before World War II, right? So the foundations of Hitler in Germany and the foundations of Mussolini in Italy. And we'll, again, begin next week with each of those leaders, each of those dictators in charge of their respective countries, and what life is like, how they rule their people, and how their actions, their thoughts, and their beliefs are going to lead the world to a second world war. So with that, we thank you for listening, and we will see you all later. Goodbye.
We hope you've enjoyed this look back into the week that was in global history. The goal, as always, is to be enlightened. If not enlightened, at least entertained. For global updates throughout the week, follow Mr. P on Twitter at Mr. P_Braves. And remember, this isn't just his story or her story. It's your story, too.